Author Peter Cole on The Hidden History of Local 8, an interracial union of Philadelphia longshore workers comprised of mostly African Americans and Eastern European immigrants affiliated with the radical industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies.
For much of its time, Local 8 was majority black, always with a cadre of black leaders. They exercised effective control over the Philadelphia docks from 1913 to 1922. This was a time when mainstream AF&L unions either excluded African American workers or relegated them to segregated locals. Local 8 was one of the most powerful interracial unions seen in the U.S. prior to the CIO era, and we are pleased to welcome author Peter Cole.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let's go a little bit deeper into this now, especially considering the period of time we're talking to, which was around the World War I era. What was so different about Local 8, especially on the race issue?
What made Local 8 special was that they were doing what few other organizations were doing at that time. And when I say organizations, I don't even just mean unions. Across the board, really, America was at perhaps the nadir of race relations. So what Local 8 did at that time was almost unthinkable, which is namely including blacks and whites in the same organization, having black leaders as well as white leaders in the same organization, integrating their meetings, integrating their social gatherings. When it comes to the race issue, Local 8 was perhaps the single most progressive organization of its time.
And how did it manifest itself? What did that leadership accomplish? What were the issues and demands that gave it that edge that all too often, certainly, we don't see in organized labor today?
A lot of the demands deal with things that you might call bread and butter, things that sort of make the lives of workers better. That includes, of course, for longshoremen, the hiring process, which was known as the shape-up, was notoriously rigged against workers. Lots of people show up on the docks to get work. Dock work, while that was actually hard labor, but it doesn't require tremendous skill. And so the dock workers in Local 8 were able to tell the bosses, we're not going to have a shape-up anymore. Instead, you can call the union hall, and we will send you the workers who we deem to be appropriate for the job. And so they were able to deliver the goods in some really practical ways. They did that because they were able to organize everybody. So one issue, the first question, kind of, of course, relates to the second one that Mimi asked. Without having everybody in the union, then you can't make those sorts of demands on employers. Employers won't listen.
Let's make this a little bit more concrete also. Let's compare Local 8 in Philadelphia. I mean, when I first thought about it, I didn't realize that Philadelphia was such a large port, mm-hmm. especially around that time. Compare it to the ILA, the International Longshoremen's Association, which organized the New York port.
New York City was the biggest port in America, and a lot of New York's greatness is because of its dominance as an amazing freshwater port on the Atlantic seaboard. And New York City had more longshoremen, really, than anywhere else in America. Tens of thousands of people worked the docks, and there was no other port in America as big as New York City. Philadelphia, though, in terms of volume of its shipping in the World War I era, was in the top three or four, and had anywhere from 5,000 to 8,000 people potentially working on the waterfront. The ILA, which organized some people in New York City, controlled some of the docks, especially actually the Chelsea piers on Manhattan Island and some of the other piers in Brooklyn. The ILA basically was anti-democratic. Members who tried to challenge the leadership of their own union were often beaten up, thrown out of the union or whatnot. The ILA also segregated its members into different locals based upon ethnicity or race. The Irish Americans dominated the waterfront. There were Italians in the ILA, but in segregated locals, especially in the Brooklyn piers. And then there were actually a few black locals, which actually didn't control specific piers, but sort of floated among different piers and essentially picked up the dregs, right? In Philadelphia, by contrast, which the ILA did not control, although they wanted to for throughout the World War I era, there is a single local. That local is all deep-sea longshoremen. They also had other branches for people who did other sorts of work on the waterfront. For instance, coastal ships that plied the Atlantic seaboard but didn't travel Atlantic. And that single local was integrated. It had, therefore, a very different look to it. And it wasn't simply because there were a lot of black folks on the waterfront, but also because the union, the IWW, was committed to having an integrated workplace and union.
One of the things that I found exciting in the book was there's this discourse and there's a flyer there that talks about the standard of living and prepare for the final emancipation of the workers. And what it does is it lays out that there is an equality of wage that is set. There's no hierarchy, so that you begin the creation of equality amongst the workers and a sense of brotherhood. And I want you to get into discussion more about Ben Fletcher and who he was and what he represented within that local.
If I could just say one thing about the first issue. People who loaded docks in different parts of the docks and who had different types of jobs actually got paid different amounts of money, just like in most workplaces. One of the amazing things about the IWW on the Philadelphia dock was that they demanded the same wages for all workers regardless of the type of work they did. And in that way, as in many others, they were truly egalitarian because, generally speaking, deep-sea longshoremen were considered the sort of the aristocrats, the lords of the docks. But they were, meanwhile, demanding the same sorts of wages for people who, in every other port in America, actually earned dramatically less money per hour. And so they were trying to lift up the deep-sea longshoremen, that is, trying to lift up the coastwise and other members of the marine transport industry. One of the people who did that so well was Ben Fletcher, a black man who was born and raised in Philadelphia, joined the IWW and the Socialist Party around the same time prior to the formation of Local 8, although a lot of the details of his personal history are, if not lost to history, deeply, deeply buried. Fletcher was considered to be a great soapbox orator, those sorts of street corner speakers who are essential to organizing not just African-American workers, but of course also in the Harlem neighborhoods throughout the 1930s and 40s and beyond. Street box speakers were an important way of reaching people. And Fletcher's commitment to the union was quite impressive because there weren't many African-Americans in the IWW before Local 8, and there weren't many, well, there were no black leaders in the IWW. And so Fletcher, the fact that he exists, of course, his personal example, shows ordinary black folks in the union that, in fact, this union is committed to equality, right? And so his example, his personal story is central, I think, to the story of Local 8.
How did this local get to be? I mean, this is an exception to the rule, mm-hmm. even among longshore locals, so it can't be explained that longshore locals were like this
right.
throughout the country. What was unique to Philadelphia that brought about this local?
One of the things that was unique, actually, was that there was no union in place yet, because what we see in many workplaces in this era, including on the docks, but not just on waterfronts, was that if there was a union in place, and since unions were almost always white-dominated, they did a really good job of keeping blacks out of the job. But because Philadelphia was unorganized prior to the arrival of Local 8, that essentially creates space. So one of the things, actually, that made Philadelphia unique was the fact that there was no union in place. The IWW also had been organizing in Philadelphia for some time in other industries. And then we also have the presence of Ben Fletcher, who is unique, unfortunately, if you're a fan of the IWW, because in Philadelphia you have an example of a black leader, a black who is a militant and committed to the struggle of the IWW, where you don't have someone like Ben Fletcher in other cities at this time.
And one of the things that I found exciting from the book was looking at what wasn't a defensive but was a proactive strike, and that was the strike that was launched on May 26, 1920. Tell us about that.
During and after World War I was a period of tremendous labor militancy. I think in 1919, about 20% of all industrial workers struck that year, and that was like no year before or percentage-wise since. A lot of those strikes were defeated, although it showed the tremendous power that workers had and empowerment they felt, but also ultimately the limits of that power. Really from 1919 through around 1922-23, we see these strikes across America, including in New York City on the waterfront, and in Philadelphia in 1920, what they're striking for are two things, which are common. One is 8-hour day, which was not yet the law of the land, and it really depended on the industry. But in most industries, it did not yet exist. But in some industries, during World War I, employers had conceded that demand. The other issue was wages, but that also sort of mimicked what was happening in many other workplaces. There was massive inflation during and after World War I, perhaps 50% from 1915 to 1920, and many workers' wages weren't keeping up. And so although their incomes had risen, their real wages had declined. So Local 8 did what many other workers and unions, not all of those workers in unions, right, both organized and unorganized workers did in that era, which is they went on strike to make these demands because employers otherwise were unwilling to listen to their workers.
It's a local of African Americans, but it's also a local of recently arrived Eastern European immigrants, many of whom did not speak English.
Mm-hmm.
Was this sort of just a marriage of convenience that both sides see that they needed each other to advance themselves, or were there real fraternity between them?
Well, that's a great question, and one of those questions that's really hard to answer once you are looking at them 70, 80 years in the past. You could say it's a marriage convenience, but of course, in that same period of time, there's only a handful of examples where you do see blacks and Eastern European immigrants organizing together. The other classic example really is the Chicago meatpacking in that time. In that same era, though, you see actually generally the reverse. You see, for instance, in the Great Steel Strike of 1919, hundreds of thousands of steelworkers across the country striking and blacks being used as strike breakers, not joining the union, those who are already in the steel industry. In Philadelphia, you do have, again, leadership rising up from the ranks of the Polish and Lithuanian communities. Before the war, you have some Poles and Lithuanians, well, especially Poles, who are active and leaders in Local 8. And then during and after the war, you have a Lithuanian and Polish, I don't know for certain, but Polly Baker, a man who anglicized his name, but who was a Lithuanian immigrant, spoke Polish and Lithuanian. He could speak to those 1,000 to 2,000 East European immigrants, and he was a committed Wobbly as well. He arrived, like many immigrants in that time, but lots of East Europeans became pretty committed to unionism in the World War I era. And so it is both convenient because it's pragmatic, but it wasn't just that, because we see, again, success on the Philadelphia waterfront that we don't find elsewhere.
And we have been speaking with author Peter Cole. Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia, by author Peter Cole.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report. Thank you for listening.